Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with artist Justin Gariglia about why he gave up photojournalism to pursue environmental activism through provocative art installations. He'll be speaking in Cedar Falls tomorrow. But before we get to that, Andre Perry of Iowa City has just published a new collection of essays. It's called Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now. The essays explore issues of race, racism, homophobia, self-discovery, and identity. Perry is the executive director of the Englert Theater in Iowa City. He's also co-founder of both the Mission Creek and Witching Hour festivals. This is his first book. He'll be at Next Page Bookstore in Cedar Rapids tonight at 7 p.m. Thursday, he'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m., and he is with me now. Andre, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
Thank you so much for being here. And this collection of essays, you don't put dates on things in the essays, but I get the impression that it covers about 20 years of your life. I'm curious, when you started pulling these essays together, did you go back and look at things you had written then, or is this a new collection?
I try to not look at anything that was written 20 years ago. I don't think it's appropriate for anyone to look at. I slowly was calling together the information and the reflections in these essays probably over the last like 10 or so years in other little bits, other essays that might have existed in different forms. And it was probably over the last 2 to 3 years that I really began to see the shape of it. And then I started to get that focus, and then I would go back and, you know, maybe pull something from an old piece or an old note or an old email, an old letter, and that would kind of inform the information that was going into these. So I think the thinking of it maybe a decade old, even though some of the stuff is much, much older than that in terms of the time frame.
What drove this project? As you talk about it starting to come together and take shape, it's a pretty diverse collection of essays. So what drove the project? What was it that made you want to put these together?
Yeah, I think the idea that these essays are trying to circle around is this thought that, you know, maybe you're grown up, and that's with air quotes around it, and maybe you're 22, maybe you're 21, whatever it is, maybe you went to college, maybe you're in the service, and the world, or maybe you have this existential, you know, thought that the world wants you to be grown up and to have come of age and to be moving through your space with knowledge and confidence. But I found when I was growing up and out of college, like, I almost felt like I knew nothing, and that is when I began to maybe have my search and have my journey towards figuring out what is my cultural identity, how do I move through the space that is the world in, you know, 2000, and how do I actually like build a life that's going to be meaningful, maybe like give back to the community. And so I think this book is about the journey of like, how do you figure out who you are? You know, what are the situations in life that challenge you? Whether there are, you know, like existential attacks from the outside world or just internal things that you're working through. It's about that process, which I do believe a number of us go through.
I think that's safe to say. You grew up in the Washington, D.C. area?
Yeah, D.C. born and raised.
And you write a little bit about going to school in D.C. Tell me a little bit about the school you went to, the high school.
Yeah, I went to the school called St. Albans, which is part of the National Cathedral Schools. And so there's a cathedral school for boys and the cathedral school for girls. I went to the boys, and it's a classic D.C. prep school. And it's part of this prep school network that's in D.C. And there are a lot of different kids there. St. Albans I loved because it was they pulled a – despite having like, you know, the kids of politicians and things like that, there are also just like normal people who just grew up in D.C. and maybe their parents weren't these rich lawyers. They were just normal people. And so I think they really actively tried to build as diverse of a culture as they could within that particular school, with it being this like, you know, like hallowed prep school next to like a cathedral. But it also brought with it, I think, just like a lot of history of what it means to grow up in like the shadow of privilege in the United States of America. I do speak about it in the book, perhaps somewhat critically, but I have a lot of love for it. You know, I spoke with one of my teachers who really informed me while I was there. He was this black professor who was at the school, and he introduced me to so much of the literature that I think influenced me from then on. The first time I encountered James Weldon Johnson or Richard Wright, and he took these old texts and made them relevant for my life in the 90s. And so I've got a lot of good memories about St. Albans.
The story that you share in one of your essays is an ugly story, but it's not something that is foreign to anybody who's gone through high school, probably, a story about bullying, about racism, about homophobia. And later on, you write about a trip that you took when you were in college. You went to Princeton.
I did.
College.
Yeah.
All right. And then you took a trip to Virginia Tech, and you went there to see friends from high school. And it sounds like that was a real culture shock for you, having gone to this prep school in Washington, D.C., having gone to Princeton, then getting to Virginia Tech State School. What was the culture shock about that?
Yeah, it was actually University of Virginia,
which
they would care about.
Right.
But I think it's important that it's Virginia because it's in Charlottesville, which obviously has a different light now, given, you know, recent events over the last couple of years. But it's like one of the best universities in the country, right? You know, it's UVA, great athletic tradition, great academic tradition. It's the home of Jefferson, right? You know, he went there, made the university. And so when I went to go visit, I was a freshman in college. I had so many friends from high school who went there because it's so close to D.C. And some of my friends were black, some of my friends were white. And I showed up and they just all kind of dispersed to different parts of the campus. One, that happens. But it was clearly because there was like such a deep racial divide in the community there that it just kind of blew my mind that, all of the black culture would be in different parts of the campus or different, you know, moving through different circles. All of the white culture, all of the other people would be doing all the other things, and that there was this real almost impenetrable divide, which did not exist where I went to school up north in Princeton. But it exists everywhere, right? You know, it exists in so many places. And for me to have that wake up moment, I think, was kind of shocking, and it took a little while to process it.
Well, and it's interesting what you were just saying about the prep school you went to, how that was an intentional community built on diversity and equality, and then to go to a large university where maybe nobody had been intentional about trying to create a diverse community where people interacted. Your friends were self-segregating, but they were also blending into this system that had been there forever.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And it's not to say that there aren't, you know, crisscrossing cultures existing in University of Virginia. And that was also, you know, like over 20 years ago. And I know some things have changed. And I also know like professors who are there who are really like forward thinking in the way that they're trying to bring different students together. But yeah, it seemed as if the culture at such a hallowed university represented an intentional segregational mindset. And I guess it's not a surprise now. Now I'm old. And so like these things don't shock me, but when you're like a kid, they shock you.
Did it change how you thought about yourself in that moment?
I think it was it was the first of many wake-up calls to really consider geographically and culturally what spaces I would choose to put myself in if I so had a choice, and realizing that the culture that I live in has an effect on my mental health, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and also you share throughout these essays coming to the realization that you do have a choice and what a privilege that is.
Yeah.
From school, maybe not a direct path, but then you moved out to San Francisco. What drew you to San Francisco?
I think I was just trying to get away from the East Coast. And, you know,
so you went as far as you possibly could go.
Yeah, just to get away from home and to try something new. I had thought about moving to Los Angeles to work in the film and television world. And I did have some opportunities down there, but there was something about the pull of San Francisco, which is, in its stereotype and truly in practice is a place where I think like dreamers go, where you just like want to find a different path and you don't have it all figured out. It's a great place, I think, to like lose yourself in a different path or to like literally get lost or maybe to find yourself, kind of depending how it works out. But that allure was there, and so I picked the Bay Area.
And this was really a time of self-discovery for you. It sounds like maybe you were a little aimless at that moment.
Or always.
So revisiting that time in your life, what did that feel like from the perspective of 2019?
The thing that I love about writing and having gone to school actually at Iowa where I got my MFA is that you learn how time actually like really helps you better pull through all of the complex threads that make up our lives. Whether you're writing essays or fiction or poetry, that distance of time really helps you understand everything that is going on in your life, everything that's going on in the world. You can never truly get to the final answer, but you can perhaps get closer to an honest reflection of where we are emotionally and make sense of events that might have been totally confusing or shattered you at the time. I think Joan Didion in the White Album, you know, she's writing about events that happened 10 years prior, right? And one of her points in that essay is that even though she still can't like fully make sense of what was happening at that time, it's just that distance of time has allowed her to have a better sense of like she can at least present the threads of we're talking about the civil rights movement. We're talking about the Manson murders in California. We're talking about just, you know, unrest on campuses. We're talking about personal like mental anguish and like mental issues. And she's able to step back 10 years later and just take a look and be like, okay, I still don't understand this, but at least these are the things that were happening. And I felt very much in the same way as I looked back into my time in the Bay Area and San Francisco. Okay, now I can start to unthread some of these different things that are happening in my life and the lives around me.
Well, and we're going to have to take a short break here, but a lot of what you explore in your essays is racism in America, you know, throughout your lifetime and the power of the N-word, which you've encountered in so many different ways. So we'll talk about that when we get back in just a moment. I'm talking with Andre Perry of Iowa City. He's just published a new collection of essays. It's called Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now. He's the executive director of the Englert Theater in Iowa City. He'll be at Next Page Bookstore in Cedar Rapids tonight at 7, at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City Thursday night at 7. And we will be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In about 15 minutes, I'll talk with artist Justin Bryce Gariglia about his environmental activism through provocative art installations. He'll be in Cedar Falls tomorrow and putting up one of his art installations, We Are the Asteroid, number 2, will be on display in Cedar Falls starting tomorrow. With me now is Andre Perry of Iowa City. He's just published a new collection of essays, Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now. And the essays explore many issues, including race and racism, homophobia, self-discovery, identity. Perry is the executive director of the Englert Theater in Iowa City. He's also the co-founder of both the Mission Creek and Witching Hour festivals. He will be at Next Page Bookstore in Cedar Rapids tonight at 7 p.m. Thursday, he'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m. And Andre, just before the break, I brought up the fact that the N-word, that terrible racial slur, makes itself known through many of your essays and through many of your life experiences. And you write about how when you moved to Iowa City and you were writing and going through the writer's workshop, you were sometimes frustrated with being, I guess, pigeonholed as a Black writer. You know, the people in the workshop would say to you, this could be a Black essay. And tell us more about what was going through your mind and what that meant to you as a writer and a Black man to have that critique of your writing at that point.
Sure. One clarification. I went to the nonfiction writing program.
Okay, sorry.
Which is fine. But I point that out because there are so many different voices in that program because mm-hmm. It's like you bring in experimental writers, people who came from the poetry world, people who were journalists, people who are in the great essay tradition. And so I think you have a room of people at any given time, at any given workshop of folks who are just coming from so many different angles and trying to like in their effort to try to create the new voice in an essay or to create a new form of an essay, would ask every possible question, you know, and that was just like the nature of workshop. And so that just kind of was what it was. But in terms of like moving through that space as one of the only Black people in the program, and dealing with like feedback from classmates, from friends, from professors, you know, it was like that moment of being in Charlottesville and being in Virginia, where you're just really forced to question how will you move through the space that you've chosen or the space that you exist in if you haven't chosen it, and how can you survive in that space, you know? And not to say that being in a workshop is a moment of like, you know, like life or death, but it does have, I think, a big effect on your mental condition.
Well, there's tremendous pressure. I mean, I think everybody who's been through an MFA program would say that, you know, you've got 2 years and it feels like a make or break moment in your life, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you're definitely stressed and there's pressure because you're meant to be something. You've already made this choice that like 90% of parents are like, I can't believe you're doing this. Of all the things you could be doing with your life, you're going to get like an MFA in writing in Iowa. No, but there's a lot of pressure because you want to be great, you know, and not to be great to like be on the, you know, to be in the New Yorker or the New York Times or whatever. This is your chance to really find your voice as an artist. And that is a huge, immense privilege to be given a couple years or 3 years or whatever it is to be able to sit and try to find your voice. And you don't want to fail because people decided that you were going to come into the space and you were going to try to put words to a page and have them actually mean something. And so balancing that pressure with trying to figure out how you would represent, you know, your cultural identity on a page or how that would affect the things that you're researching or writing about, for me was both a burden, but I also knew it was an opportunity. And I wasn't, you know, there were moments where I think maybe I felt slighted or, you know, felt bad like coming out of a workshop or a discussion. But, you know, you take the advantages you have, you take the privileges you have and you run with them and you take the experiences and you make sure you learn from them and you make better work. You know, I don't think I tried to let it slow me down. Maybe had some like sad nights for sure. But I still have those. So, you know, I made the best of it, I think.
Well, you had been through this journey going to San Francisco and, you know, really trying to find yourself and find your identity. And then coming to the nonfiction writing program, you were, in a way, there were people telling you what your identity should be. And that wasn't coming from you.
No. It was definitely not coming from me. And I think, you know, I think that's just a reality of being in an academic institution in the United States of America in the 2000s. And so it's not, I don't think it's like particular just to being in a graduate program at the University of Iowa and an MFA. It's happening at Indiana. It's happening at Harvard. It's happening at, you know, all these different institutions. I think we have, you know, we're diversifying classrooms, we're diversifying academia, and it's not going to all be pretty, right?
Right.
And so some of us are going to have it a little bit harder. So hopefully those of us coming 10 years later have a little bit better, and those who were 10 years before me probably had it a lot harder. So you just have to keep changing the system and being strong. And when you do hear like feedback that is maybe inappropriate, you just got to just find that courage and just say what's up, and knowing that you might not even be supported when you stand up to say what's up. I mean, to circle back to this particular program, generally speaking, I felt everyone was supportive. You know, it's you're kind of like in a pressure cooker, so I think sometimes things come out that someone wouldn't say in a less intense situation. But the professors overall were pretty awesome. You know, John Nagata, who's the head of the program now, was there. Just as a professor, he's an intense reader, but he's got big eyes, big ears, and he's looking for all ways to give feedback to his students so that they can become more adventurous writers. And at the end of the day, that's why you're there. You know, can you become a better writer than you were? I maybe came in way low, I think, beneath some of the writers, but relative to where I was when I showed up and to where I ended up, I was hundreds of times better.
So when you started pulling these essays together, as I mentioned, I mean, there's a lot of exploration of the N-word and how powerful and devastating that word has been for you at different times in your life. And it's provocative, but it's troubling to read. It's a little bit shocking from, you know, my safe, sheltered perspective. For you, why did that become an important part of the story that you wanted to tell? Was there a moment when you realized, I need to express what this feels like because a lot of people don't get it?
Part of it was just ensuring that those experiences were captured and recorded so that, not that people don't know, but just to ensure that this is part of a life, no matter what your privilege level might be, if you're black or brown coming up in this world, right, and in America in particular. That's one part of it. The other side of it is by talking about the N-word in instances in which it comes up or which it is even just insinuated through other actions is a key to a door that opens up to talk about, I think, some of the bigger systemic issues that are plaguing the charge of equity in the United States of America. It's a way to start thinking about what are the systems, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's voting rights, what are all of the things that you're holding us back from being, you know, keeping this distance between the country that we say we are and want to be and the country that we actually are. And so I think in this particular collection, I did use a lot of instances of the N-word to be like, okay, what's behind that? And then what's behind that?
In writing about your period of adjustment to Iowa City, clearly you feel very much at home in Iowa City. Now you've made a life here. You've made a tremendous difference to the arts community at the Englert with the Mission Creek, with Witching Hour. You are a force in Iowa City. In coming here, you write about the social stratification of Iowa City. So Iowa City is a diverse community, a very diverse community for the state of Iowa, and a diverse community, I mean, period. But in the circles in which you operate, you can feel very much alone. And I'm just share a little bit more about the view from where you are. When you look at Iowa City, you look at the university community, you look at the greater community, and the social stratification that in many ways reflects segregation.
One of the things I learned in writing this book, which was also happening parallel to me just continuing to grow up and understand life a little bit better than I did before, is that whether you're in San Francisco, whether you're in Atlanta, New York, Iowa City, Chicago, I think if you're black or brown, you know, we're always looking for the place where we can call home and feel comfortable. And at some level, it just doesn't exist. And that maybe sounds super depressing to say out loud. But it doesn't mean we can't find joy. And it doesn't mean we can't have an active role in our communities. And it doesn't mean that we can't, you know, succeed and also make things better where we are. And so a lot of this book was me, not so much on the page, but just in my mind, reflecting about Iowa City in particular and asking myself, why would I stay here? Why would I build a family and build a home here and continue to engage with the community? And very much outside the book, I think one of the reasons I like to be here is because there are lots of issues, and I think it is tough. And I meet some challenges. I also have some privileges. But I do think this is a place where we still have a chance to actually not go off the rails. When I go back to San Francisco, it is so difficult. You know, I even say this in one of the essays. It's so difficult to be someone who has been historically marginalized. It's like even hard to be white in some like situations in San Francisco at this point, due to the inequity with, you know, just people having access to funds to actually be able to live there. And Iowa City's not there. we actually still have the opportunity, I think, to actually be closer to that model of what we want an American community to look like. I think the state of Iowa still has the opportunity to look like a model American state. There's a lot that, like, I don't like. There's a lot that frustrates me, but I see a lot of promise, you know?
Before we run out of time, I would love for you to read one of the essays. And this is from almost the end of the book. And you take us on an emotional journey through the book. We feel in the beginning, you're a little lost. And by the end, you know who you are and where you are and why you are. And I felt that in the essays toward the end of the book. And you have one called Interstate. Could you read a little bit for us?
Sure. I was going 80 miles per hour down the interstate. The freezing rain was coming down fluidly and forming crystalline glaciers on my windshield. I'd been on the road for about 9 hours, and I was making incredible time. I was going to get there so early. I was going to set a new record. I pulled into the left lane. I had the audacity to pass a truck. He was going about 70, and that was way too slow. I was far enough ahead of him that I decided to pull back over into the right lane. I had to bend down over the steering wheel. It was so hard to see anything out of the window with all of that ice clutching at my windshield. Suddenly, the car turned inward to the left and then swished around to the right. It only took a second and a half. Oddly calm, I acknowledged that I was no longer driving, no longer controlling the situation. The car and I were floating above the road on a smooth layer of ice. The truck was coming up behind me, going 70. I didn't try to turn back. I just pressed down steadily on the brakes and let the car take its course. I wasn't sure where we were going, but I tried to slow us down to alleviate the pain of the impact. It didn't seem like we were going so fast anymore. There was a stark beauty to it, sliding around America at night in a steady metal box. For a moment, the car wasn't a car, but a small room I was sitting in, creaking back and forth as in a strong Californian earthquake. I saw that we had finally settled on a course, heading directly at the right snowbank. Everything in the car began to shift, and I thought, almost at peace, well, this is it. We soared off the road and into the ditch. The car had firmly planted itself in a plot of icy grass. I was alive. Bob Dylan's Love Minus Zero, No Limit was playing on the stereo. The bridge at midnight trembles. It seemed absurd, though any song at that moment would have seemed absurd. The truck zipped by on the interstate. What was that driver thinking about me and my hubris? I got out of the car and looked around to assess the damage. I was cold and slipping all over the grass. My car looked okay. I got back in the driver's seat. I tried driving directly out of the ditch, but that was impossible. Instead, I put the car in first and backed up a bit so that I was in the flat part of the ditch. From there, I drove slightly up the hill in increments so that I could make it back to the shoulder and onto the road. I gathered myself, slowly pushed onto the highway, first going 40, then 50. I noticed then that in the midst of the ice storm, most cars were going that speed. I worked my way up the road, feeling less like a man or a role model, yet older and wiser. I had spoken to my parents on the phone earlier from the road, and they had said, "Be careful." And though I had known then that they were right, I only now truly understood them. As I drove, I wondered if every piece of wisdom they had shared with me had been matched by some similar experience. It was then that I knew to some degree what it meant to be a parent and to live a long, full life. I thought of you and the future children we might have. I moved slowly, but with confidence, into the night.
Andre Perry reading his essay Interstate from his collection Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now. And we only have about a minute left, but in the book, you ask a lot of questions, but you don't give us a lot of answers. You make us think a lot. But what do you hope your readers take away from these essays and this experience?
I hope this book is an opportunity for us to think about how we're moving through the world, who we are, really who we are. And it's an encouragement for us to get closer to honesty. Not to say that we're all lying all the way through our lives every day, but there is a lot of noise. And who are we really, and what are we supposed to be doing here, and how can we be better community members, better citizens to everyone else around us?
And the appearances that you're doing in the next couple of days are going to be conversations, not just readings. So are you hoping to really open up those conversations in a bigger way?
Yes. The whole book tour, I'm talking with someone different pretty much every night, you know, the ones I'm doing in the Midwest, the ones in the East Coast and the West Coast. it's, hey, there. I say a lot of things in this book, but there are a lot of perspectives to bring to the topics I'm bringing up. So in each community, let's have a conversation. Let's go there and let's see what happens. So,
well, Andre Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andre Perry, the book is Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now. It's a collection of essays, and he will be at the Next Page Bookstore in Cedar Rapids tonight at 7 p.m. He'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City Thursday night at 7 p.m. He is also the executive director of the Englert Theater in Iowa City. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with artist Justin Gariglia about his environmental activism through art, using art to change the world. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.